We are living made of water.
Down the river, follow the current down.
Live on land, return to river.
Follow the current down.
Welcome to the second statewide call-in show as part of Connecting the Drops, a year-long collaboration on Colorado water issues with the Colorado Foundation for Water Education and Rocky Mountain Community Radio Stations. I'm Maeve Conran at KGNU in Boulder. We welcome all of our listeners around the state to this call-in show. Joining us by phone, Ken Carlson. Ken is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Colorado State University. He's also the director of the Center for Energy Water Sustainability within the CSU Energy Institute. Good afternoon, Ken. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And joining us by phone also is Kent Halsinger, a natural resources attorney in Denver specializing in water and energy issues. Good afternoon, Kent. Thank you for being with us.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
Later in the show, we will be joined by Sloane Shoemaker, who's head of the Western Slope Conservation Group Wilderness Workshop. We'll be getting his thoughts around the issue of energy and water. That is the subject of today's show. And first of all, Ken Carlson, you have about 20 years experience working in water related issues. Here in northeastern Colorado, we've seen significant oil and gas development, and this energy development is largely occurring in agricultural areas with a significant reliance on water resources. Now, you've been studying this interface between water, energy and agriculture. What are the major questions that you're asking as a scientist?
Well, we got involved a little over 3 years ago. CSU, as people that have been in the state for a while may know, has a long history in water and agriculture, and it became apparent around that time frame that we needed to bring some of that expertise to understanding these issues, as hydraulic fracturing in the northeast part of the state really, really started accelerating and has continued to accelerate, and really has become an issue that a lot of people is on a lot of people's minds. So the kind of questions we started asking initially were, what is the water being used for? How much is the water relative to other use? That began about a 2 year study. We called it a water intensity study to really look carefully at the life cycle use of water in oil and natural gas extraction with the newer techniques that are being used. And we compared that with other fuel sources and other energy sources like coal and nuclear and wind and biofuels. So I can talk about that in a little bit if there's interest. But the other thing was really, we really recognized as a need was effective water management. CSU has interfaced with a lot of different groups to look at water management issues, everything from irrigation to municipal wastewater to food manufacturers, and it seemed like this was different than oil and gas in the state had been before. And so we've really, my group has spent a lot of time working with industry, the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and others to understand the best way to handle the water, to manage the water. Many of the operators in Colorado are pretty committed to recycling the flowback, and there's challenges associated with that. So we have several projects working with companies like Noble Energy and Halliburton, and we've worked with Encana to increase the amount of water recycling that is done. So I think I'll just leave it at that. We've actually have several other water quality related research projects underway also, but we've thrown ourselves into it and feel like we're trying to. Well, I'll just say one more thing is we're conscious about being a middleman, a broker of knowledge, helping to solve problems and not advocating for or against, just trying to make it better.
That's Ken Carlson. He is a professor at CSU. He's the director of the Centre for Energy Water Sustainability within the CSU Energy Institute. Kent Halsinger, you're a natural resources attorney in Denver. You specialise really in water issues. How much water is the oil and gas industry actually using? Maybe we can start off with those figures and go from there.
Sure, that's a great question. When it comes to Colorado water, oil and gas is really the least of our worries. Oil and gas uses only about 0.1% of all of Colorado's water use. Put in quantified terms, we're talking about 20,000 acre feet. And to put that in perspective, Colorado's annual water use is more like 15 or 16 million acre feet. One of our reservoirs alone on the western slope holds about 1 million acre feet of water. So the amount we're talking about when it comes to hydraulic fracturing is really that proverbial drop in the bucket.
Well, given that, and I know there are a lot of studies that back you up to say that in the overall scheme of things, the amount of water, if you compare it to some of the other industries, particularly agriculture here in the state, that it may be not as much as certainly a lot of people might think. However, is the impact of water use in different areas, is it affecting different areas in a different way? And maybe, Ken Carlson, I'll ask you about this. Because, say, for example, the city of Greeley sold several hundred million gallons of water to the oil and gas industry. And that water is getting essentially trucked in big semi-trucks to rural areas for some of those fracking operations. And so even though if you look at statewide, the amount of water being used by the oil and gas industry, it seems that certain areas are more impacted by that. Ken Carlson, maybe is that something you could address?
Yes, and that is, that's adding a little more color to the numbers. The 0.1% is correct on a statewide basis, but it's not homogeneous as you're saying, and so I don't think, but it is all within, and Ken would know a lot more than I do about this, it's all within existing water laws. It's not like people are taking water that they don't have the right to take. So it's all within a pretty well-vetted Colorado legal framework for acquiring water. With that said, my experience is that the larger operators in the state are pretty sensitive to the fact that parts of the population, parts of rural Weld County, for example, may feel that they're being priced out of the water market, and thus they are working hard to either not use those water sources, maybe going to deeper aquifers that because of the energy required to pump them to the surface are not cost-effective to use for agriculture, but might be that they will use them for hydraulic fracturing. Or what I was mentioning earlier, these programs to recycle water and not just use water that could be used for municipal or ag purposes, reuse the flowback water that they're already generating.
Well,
I might just jump in real quick on the issue of water use in Greeley. Greeley last year used about 22,000 acre feet of water, and their sales for oil and gas were about 1,500 acre feet. So it's still a very small percentage of, even in the midst of some of the most active oil and gas operations in the state today, it's still a very small percent. And let's not forget the revenues that come in to Greeley and farmers for leasing their water that to these companies. That's a hugely important economic factor as well.
Well, yeah, and I would say that no one's forcing Greeley to sell their water. And there was a large Aurora recently, I think, with more controversy 2 years ago, leased a large amount of water to an operator. And one of the reasons they did it was they felt that they could reduce rates to their customers.
That's a great point, too, Ken. And Aurora, that particular lease with Aurora was for reusable effluent. So that's water that had already been consumed and used by the city once. So that was another great example.
Well, we're going to get into some of those other issues, and particularly looking at, well, we're talking right now about quantity of water, but in a little bit we'll talk about the quality of water and how the oil and gas industry impacts water quality here in the state. I would like to remind our listeners that you are tuned in to Community Radio KGNU as well as KRCC in Colorado Springs, KDNK in Carbondale. It's a statewide call-in show as part of Connecting the Drops, a year-long collaboration on Colorado water issues with the Colorado Foundation for Water Education. I'm Maeve Conran in the KGNU studios. Joining us now by phone is Ken Carlson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Colorado State University. He's the Director of the Center for Energy Water Sustainability within the CSU Energy Institute. Also joining us is Kent Halsinger, a natural resources attorney in Denver. We were talking there about how the oil and gas industry in the larger scheme of things uses less water, certainly than other industries in the state. But water use for fracking, is that 100% consumptive? And I'm referring now to a recent report by Western Resource Advocates. They have a fact sheet regarding fracking our future, measuring water and community impacts from hydraulic fracturing. They say that while 90 to 95% of residential water used indoors returns to a wastewater treatment plant and is ultimately released to streams or reused, when water is used in fracking, that's 100% consumptive. Ken Carlson, can you talk about that?
So that's an important issue, and I think when we look at water use and studies nationally in the state, you can break it into consumptive use or withdrawal, and so agriculture, when they withdraw water, much of it, I think people would say maybe 60% or so, returns to be used again, and as you said, urban use maybe is more than that. Statewide, the Oil and Gas Commission, the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission, would say that around 50%, they've started reporting those numbers, is recycled at least once. And but there's variability. There's the way we extract oil and gas, or mainly natural gas, in the southwest part of the state where there's coal bed methane, allows a lot more water recycling than it does in the northeast part of the state that we're sort of focusing on right now. And I'll go back to what I said we're doing a lot of work on, is the recycling, the treatment, and the ability to use that water in an industrial sense for fracturing is a big topic. It's a lot of the operators are putting a lot of effort into being able to do that. So we expect to see the numbers go up. Right now, they're probably less than 10% in the Denver-Julesburg Basin in terms of recycling. So Laura's estimation is reasonable that it's all consumed in the DJ Basin. But 5 years from now, those numbers will be different, I would expect.
Well, let's move on to the impact. Go ahead. Kent Halsinger, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Maeve. There's one postscript. Robert Chase at Marietta College has studied this issue of the water cycle and how hydraulic fracturing impacts it. And he's found something very interesting, and that's the combustion of the resources is actually producing a net gain in water to the water cycle because of the chemical compounds and the chemical processes in that combustion. So even if you consider that not all of the water used for fracking is produced from that well, the resource that's extracted in the combustion of that resource adds even more water into the cycle.
That's Kent Halsinger. He is a natural resources attorney in Denver. Also joining us is Ken Carlson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Colorado State University, Director of the Center for Energy Water Sustainability within the CSU Energy Institute. We've been talking about the amount, the quantity of water being used by the oil and gas industry. Now we're going to move on to the quality of water and the impact on water systems, whether it's surface water or groundwater. And the Colorado Oil and Gas Commission database and spills reports over 100 spills in 2013 impacting either surface or groundwater. So there is an impact to water quality in the state due to oil and gas activity. Ken Carlson, how are you looking at this issue, and what is the reality regarding water quality in the oil and gas industry?
I think the statistic is that there were 113 spills, and the impact on ground and surface water wasn't as clear, but I get your point. So let's break the potential mechanisms or possibilities for water contamination into that. That's one of them. Surface contamination, spills, leakages from tanks or something like that. Another one that people would point to is the casing, that as the fluids come back, the oil, water, and gas come back, they come back usually through an aquifer. Often that aquifer is used. And so if that casing is not sealed, is not of high integrity, there could be leakage there. And then there's a third, more subtle mechanism where the gas might be able to go up around the outside of the casing if it's not properly sealed. Those are the things that the COGCC was looking for when they enacted their rule, their groundwater monitoring rule, I think May of last year. Before then, the Oil and Gas Association, COGA, had a voluntary rule in place for several years. So there's actually been a fair amount of aquifer monitoring of a lengthy list of water quality, potential water quality contaminants. And I wouldn't say that there has not been any contamination, because that's not true, but it's not widespread. In January, we published an article looking at the last two years of water quality analysis, and we were looking at methane, because methane seems to be one of the contaminants that we're most interested in, we as the population. It's the most likely to travel underground. It's not a surface contaminant. And we did find that 98% of the wells, 98%+ of the wells were not contaminated, but there was a small number that were contaminated with methane. And talking with COGCC, they had responded to these, and they were working on mitigation efforts. So one of our conclusions from this study that we really did with COGCC was that there is a risk, and I don't think anybody was surprised about that. We wanted to know how great the risk was. Were we seeing 50% of groundwater wells being contaminated? Were we seeing 1%? And it was closer to 1%. Now, it's to follow on with that a little bit, there's no telling when these wells were contaminated. And it's likely that they were done 10, 15 years ago or more, before some of the regulations came into place in 2009, 2010, that things like all pits needed to be either lined or closed. The casing integrity requirements became much greater. So just to close there, there is a risk. It seems to be small, at least with respect to methane. We didn't find any other sort of contaminants in the database. And we need to do better. We need to reduce the risk even further, and I think that that's what at least our group's working on. I think many parts of industry are committed to that also.
Well, we're going to pick up that issue of water quality in just a moment. And Ken Carlson, we're just going to take a brief pause to let our stations identify themselves. And I will be asking you, you know, have enough studies, in fact, been done to really look at the impact of water quality as a result of oil and gas development? And we'll be bringing in the voice of a conservationist. After the break, we'll be hearing from Sloane Shoemaker, head of the Western Slope Conservation Group Wilderness Workshop. But we will be back in just a moment on this statewide call-in show, a collaboration on Colorado water issues, connecting the drops with the Colorado Foundation for Water Education.
river, follow the current down.
Live on land, return to river,
follow the current down.
River sings in many voices, living water bless us all. Everyone a different story,
follow the current down.
Desert colors bathed in sunlight,
down the river, follow the current down.
Ghostly red wall in the moonlight,
follow the current down.
Welcome back to our statewide call-in show looking at water and energy development in Colorado. I'm Maeve Conran at KGNU in Boulder. We have a panel of guests talking about water and the energy industry. Ken Carlson is Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Colorado State University. He's also the Director of the Center for Energy Water Sustainability within the CSU Energy Institute. Kent Halsinger is also joining us. He's a natural resources attorney in Denver. And I'm delighted now to welcome our third guest joining us from Carbondale. Sloan Shoemaker is Head of the Western Slope Conservation Group Wilderness Workshop. Sloan, welcome to the show. We're talking now about the impact of water quality due to oil and gas development. I know this is an area that you have been working on in Wilderness Workshop. What is your take on the impact on our water quality in the state?
Well, I heard your guests talk about how low the risk is, and I think that while that may be true, if that 1% of the contamination is your livelihood as a rancher, or it's your water supply as a neighborhood or an individual settlement, then that 1% is not acceptable. One of the things that we look a lot at is the effect of all the surface disturbance and on groundwater. And so the contamination, the surface water contamination, can come from a number of sources. But one of the things that when the U.S. Forest Service rates the risks to watersheds, one of the first factors they consider is the degree to which there are roads in that watershed, and roads are very destabilizing to surface water flow, surface hydrology. And in this country, in Garfield County that I'm most familiar with, we've got some very unstable geological formations, a lot of Mancos shale. This stuff moves around a lot. We're getting, you get a lot of erosion into the streams. That erosion makes it into the rivers. That smothers aquatic habitat. But we also see in the gas fields, a pattern of accidents that I don't have any statistics on it, but it's unsettling. The trucks are turning over all the time. Valves are malfunctioning. Containment ponds blow out. We had a containment pond blow out up on the Rhone Plateau, Rhone Creek area a couple of years ago, and it was only detected because it happened in the winter, and as the surface flow from one of these ponds went over a cliff, it all froze. So you had this frozen stalactite stalagmite of this effluent from one of these containment ponds and flowback ponds, and that stuff, it might, when it melted, it migrated downstream. Did it cause huge problems then? No, because they got on it. But there's so many opportunities for a contamination of the surface water that it just gives us pause, and particularly when you consider how many thousands of wells are out there and how little monitoring is actually occurring, how little enforcement folks are actually on the ground and the scope of their responsibility. And I hear your guests talking about the regulatory and the legal framework that oil and gas development is managed under, and we appreciate that. But with the rubber hits the road and how it's enforced and monitored in the field, and while there may be requirements to line pits, it doesn't happen all the time. There's a lot of slack activity going on out there, and we stumble across this stuff. And so the rules are only as good as the people out there enforcing it and their ability to do that. And we think that's one of the major failings in this whole boom.
Well, just to pick up on that point, Sloan, Ken Carlson, before we went to break, I said I did want to ask whether there have been adequate studies done to really measure the impact on water quality, the impact on water tables, groundwater of oil and gas development. And some of the points that Sloan brings up, is there even adequate regulation and adequate monitoring happening in the state?
Well, I can speak to part of that. The COGCC has some of the toughest rules in the country when it comes to protecting water supplies, protecting wildlife. The counties heavily regulate how roads are built. We've got federal laws like the Clean Water Act, Section 401, Stormwater Runoff, Section 404, Dredge and Fill. The Safe Drinking Water Act, regulating how we dispose of produced water. So we've got this complex, comprehensive regulatory scheme, and the COGCC, my understanding, has more than 64 full-time employees that are dedicated to going out on the ground, and I hear quite the contrary to Sloan, that they are aggressively enforcing against operators.
Well, how many wells are those 64 inspectors charged with monitoring across the state?
Well, I guess the question is how many wells are being drilled and where? Many wells are historic and have been producing for some time. So when you look at Garfield County as an example, there's only a handful of rigs operating in the county.
Yeah, but it's not the contemporary drilling that's the singular concern. There have been incidents of historic wells that have failed. So I don't know. That doesn't give us a whole lot of confidence. The last statistic I heard was there's maybe four inspectors in Garfield County charged with inspecting thousands of wells, and do the math.
One thing I was really impressed about with Garfield County is their Energy Advisory Board. And it's a public forum that I spoke at recently, and it's a wonderful opportunity for folks that have concerns, every neighborhood in the county represented, to say, here's what's going on with oil and gas in our county. If they spot a problem, it's addressed immediately. They know who to contact at the Oil and Gas Commission. The operators participate. I was really impressed about a great local effort to help do things as good as we can. And Colorado is really in the lead on these things.
Well, I don't think the locals are impressed. They feel like that Energy Advisory Board may have started off as a conduit for information from local citizenry to enforcement and management of the energy industry, but it's really dominated now by industry folks, and there's just a lot of cynicism about the efficacy of that as a conduit for feedback when you've got a county that is very pro oil and gas and has a history of squelching health impact assessments that could get to the bottom of this question, whether actually health...
Boy, from my experience at the Energy Advisory Board, this was just last week, the neighborhoods outnumbered the companies about 8-1.
Well, that may have been the case in that meeting.
The participation by the citizens was much greater than industry.
I'm Maeve Conran. My guests are Sloan Shoemaker, head of the Western Slope Conservation Group Wilderness Workshop. Also joining us, Ken Carlson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at CSU. He's the director of the Center for Energy Water Sustainability within the CSU Energy Institute. And Kent Halsinger, a natural resources attorney in Denver. Well, Ken Carlson, do you think that enough studies have been done? Is there ongoing scientific analysis of our water systems, groundwater, surface water, water tables, of the oil and gas industry? I mean, do we even have enough data to adequately say whether or not there has been contamination?
It's hard to say whether enough studies have been done, but what has been put in place, which I mentioned, is the rule, the groundwater monitoring rule, that requires at least two, up to four groundwater wells be monitored within a half mile of any oil and gas well that's drilled. And this database is growing, so, I mean, significantly. And so we analyzed 2 years worth of data, like I said, recently. You know, every 6 months, someone in the middle, let's say, academic institution, should be looking at it, and I think our knowledge will grow. So I think we have the systems in place to collect the data. Now, the other thing I will mention is something we've been working on at CSU with the Colorado Department of Natural Resources. They're funding most of it, and Noble Energy is a real-time water monitoring system that, when and if it's built out, would be available to the public. And thus, we could, in addition to these snapshot water monitoring data that comes in from the COGCC groundwater monitoring rule, we would have a series of surface wells and deep aquifer wells that would be looking for contamination from things like spills, from floods. And on that topic, the point Sloan brings up are very good points. And one of the things it reminds me is that problems are different, or the way we're looking at it is different. You know, we've got the southwest part of the state, the coal bed methane. We've got the Piceance, which he's talking about, Garfield County. We have Weld County, DJ Basin. They're all a little different in terms of the issues. In Weld County, one of the biggest issues is agriculture and its effect on groundwater, which I think is pretty well documented. So we try to balance the effect that ag has on groundwater through fertilization, animal feed operations, pesticides, et cetera, and oil and gas, and trying to do them both effectively.
Well, I'd like to go to the phones right now. Greg in Colorado Springs, welcome to the show. What is your question or comment?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for your time. The gentleman from the oil and gas industry, my question is this. 113 spills last year. Okay, well, you know, we're not going to be the only ones here. Eventually, I'm going to go old and die. There's other folks who have future interests in potable water. What are you doing to ensure that that number doesn't go from 113 to whatever, and instead you're polluting our water? What are you doing to make sure that don't happen? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Greg. Kent Holzinger, what is your response to that? Because Greg brings up a really good point, and Sloan brought it up earlier as well, that we can look at statistics and look at maybe the relatively low amount of water that the oil and gas industry is using. But behind all of those statistics, there are real people. And if there is a spill, it could be potentially impacting a rancher, somebody down the road in the future, their water is now polluted. What's your answer to Greg?
Well, thanks for the question, Greg. I come from a ranching family, and I've been working with water on our family ranch since I was a child. So I fully recognize how important the resources to our state, and as well as the importance of clean drinking water. But what I can tell you is we have the toughest rules on this in the nation. And we looked at this for one of our clients that's considering a recycling program. Even if water is treated to drinking water standards, if there is any spill after treatment of that drinking water standard quality, that's considered a spill, and it's subject to the requirements for remediation. And as Sloan mentioned, you know, these issues get taken care of. They're reported, they're inspected, and they're quickly addressed. So I think the state and the industry are working hard to make sure that there aren't issues that are cause for concern.
Well, I'd like to go back to the phones. Amy in Carbondale, welcome to the show. What is your question or comment?
Oh, well, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. This is for Kent Carlson. And you mentioned earlier that the study that you did with COGCC about groundwater contamination, that the risk of groundwater contamination from fracking was closer to 1%. And you stated that you didn't find contaminants in the database. And I'm wondering if this is because we don't know what contaminants to look for, or that they are not being disclosed by industry.
Ken Carlson.
Thank you for the question. Our belief, and it's not just our belief, is that there are three types of contaminant transport, one being the gas, and that's the most rapid, going from the oil and gas producing, let's say, borehole to the aquifer. The second would be a non-aqueous phase liquid, which would be like the oil itself, the benzene, the toluene, that kind of stuff. And then the third would be an aqueous phase. And we have different ways of looking at each of those to see if the concentration in the aquifer has changed relative to that. And so I guess a shorter answer to your question is that we would think that if a frac fluid component contaminated a well, you would also see benzene. Benzene is a common contaminant in oil and gasoline. And so it dissolves in water at a certain concentration. So we feel that there are surrogates that would travel along with other contaminants that we might not know they're there. And there is no produced water, meaning water coming back with oil and gas, whether people have fracked the well or not, that is good water. It's all bad. I mean, it all has oil byproducts, oil, benzene, toluene, xylene, et cetera, in it. And so starting with that as your assumption, you say, well, which ones are going to move the fastest? And is there a chance that something's moving faster than what I know is in the bad water? And our assumption is not. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, thank you.
Amy, thank you.
I'd like to add real quick on that point. I think it's important to note that Colorado requires disclosure of what's used in hydraulic fracturing.
That's Kent Halsinger. He is a natural resources attorney in Denver. Earlier, we heard from Ken Carlson. He is a CSU professor of civil and environmental engineering. He's the director of the Center for Energy, Water, Sustainability within the CSU Energy Institute. And my other guest is Sloan Shoemaker, head of the Western Slope Conservation Group Wilderness Workshop. They're my guests here on Connecting the Drops, which is a collaboration on Colorado water issues with the Colorado Foundation for Water Education on Rocky Mountain Community radio stations. We'll be back in just a moment.
We are living made of water. Down the river, follow the current down. Live on land, return to river. Follow the current down. River sings in many voices, living water bless us all. Everyone a different story, follow the current down. Desert colors bathe in sunlight, down the river, follow the current down. Ghostly red wall in
Welcome back to our statewide call-in show looking at water and energy development in Colorado. I'm Maeve Conran at KGNU in Boulder. Lots of people calling in from around the state weighing in on this topic. I'd like to go next to Peter in Pinewood Springs. Welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Hi, thank you. This is a great show. There's a time element to what we're talking about. When we talk about groundwater pollution or spills or whatever, we're talking about what's being said is that there's only been so many spills right now. The future groundwater pollution potential from deep well injection or failed casings in the future is not something that I've heard talked about now, and I think that that is a more important issue that we need to address, because the impact of that on potential drinking water supplies and agriculture in counties, you know, that are highly impacted by fracking. I think we need to talk about that, and I will take my question off the air.
Thank you very much, Peter. Ken Carlson, can you talk about that future impacts?
Yeah, that's a really good point, that groundwater generally moves very slowly, and you know, something that was to happen today that we didn't recognize, it might take years to even move a half mile and be able to see it. So one of the
the things we were looking at in our study of the water quality data in Weld County was with the knowledge that there are 22,000 active wells in Weld County in the DJ Basin. And most of those are older wells, ranging back to the 70s, the early 70s. And just recently are they the horizontal, long lateral length, high volume water wells. And like I said before, the casing requirements, the pit lining really came in, was really strengthened in the, around the 2009 timeframe. So there are, let's say, 18 to 19,000 legacy wells in Weld County before there was a real focus on this, and the regulations weren't as strong as they are now. And so we were looking to see, you know, do we see a signal? Do we see something that says that there's this catastrophe waiting to happen, let's say, as the groundwater moves? And we can't conclude that it's not happening, but we couldn't find any data that said it was, even in the midst of this large amount of activity in a relatively small area. And then that's the only way I can answer the question is we look at Weld County that has a high density, and we plotted the density of where the wells were and where the water quality samples were. And so we had some high-density well areas, and they didn't look any different than the low-density well areas. And so this is something that we need to continue to look at. And we have not done that sort of analysis in Garfield County, so I can't really speak to that. But in Weld County, there was no indication that there was this large-scale systemic contamination.
That's Ken Carlson, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at CSU. He's the Director of the Center for Energy Water Sustainability within the CSU Energy Institute. We'll go back to the phones and welcome Dieter in Carbondale. Welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Thank you so much. I really want to thank the university people and the scientific community for buckling up on the matter and overcoming some resistances to start their research. I would really appreciate their presence in Garfield County. So that was my comment. Continuing with my comment, I would like to also thank the industry people for their sincere effort at preventing spills and mitigating problems that occur. For the question I would like to ask, do we have to drill absolutely everywhere? I mean, chances are there may be some gas under every single square foot of the surface of the United States. Do we have to drill absolutely everywhere? We already know that we can only drill for a certain amount of existing gas because we're going to run into serious problems with CO2 increases and global warming. So here's the question. Do we have to drill everywhere? How about the Thompson Divide? Thank you so much.
Dieter, thank you for that call. Kent Halsinger, natural resources attorney. Well, that's a pretty good question maybe for somebody working closely with industry. Because it's under the ground, do we have to drill for it? And to add on to Dieter's question, how much more is under the ground in Colorado? What is the forecast for the reserves in the state, particularly with the speed at which we're extracting the resources? How long do you expect this to go on?
Well, all great questions. You know, you might remember back in the 70s predictions that we would have run out of our natural resources already. But the reality is emerging technologies are allowing us to breathe new life into old fields. We're really taking advantage of these technologies to reduce the impacts on the surface, to reduce some of those impacts that Sloan mentioned concerns about. Rather than doing many, many vertical wells, folks now have combined the technologies of directional drilling and hydraulic fracturing. And doing so really lessens the footprint on the ground. So we should be embracing these new technologies and the way they're changing the way we develop our resources. And, you know, we owe it to ourselves to develop our resources domestically. We have the toughest environmental laws. It's good for the environment. It's good for our communities. It's good for the economy. So we should take advantage of our own resources rather than importing from countries like Venezuela and Russia that don't have anywhere near the environmental protections. You know, a huge amount of our state is set aside as federal lands, as wilderness areas. There are tremendous protections in place for those special places.
Well, Kent Haldinger, I'd like to bring Sloan Shoemaker in. Sloan, the Western Slope Conservation Group Wilderness Workshop, he directs that. What's your response to Kent Haldinger?
Well, I think Ken sets up a handy straw man. The only options aren't to develop our fossil fuels here or to import from nasty dictators overseas.
Now back to our callers. Jim in Boulder, welcome to the show. What is your question or comment?
Hi. I remember reading that Mark Williams, the hydrologist at the University of Colorado, on an NSF team studying fracking, he said we're sacrificing these aquifers, that the EPA allows aquifers to be polluted in 1,500 places that supply half of the nation's drinking waters, and he's referring to oil and gas drilling and mining companies. They do things where they're supposed to have some sort of infrared sensor for pollution, and instead they weaken it from the draft so that the final rule for trying to look at oil and gas wells is just something AVO, just drive by, listen, and smell. And he's just full of things that are trying to distract us. The main thing is that these are toxic things that they inject. 150 of them are endocrine disrupting chemicals, so very tiny amounts can pollute huge amounts of water, and then you end up with fish that are neither male or female and possibly birth defects in people. Like there are heart defects being found near gas and oil wells. So you've got all these chemicals, xylene, benzene, toluene, ethyl benzene, all of those things are in there. In the industry, they don't want to like put some sort of chemical so we can track where their stuff goes, so we can say which well's polluting something. They don't want to have higher quality well casings that will protect the water from leaks. There are all these statistics that say almost all of the wells leak eventually. It just takes a while before they rust out.
The vast majority of the drinking water supplies in Colorado are from surface water. The only aquifers that serve drinking water supplies are primarily in the South Metro part of the Denver area, where oil and gas is not occurring at a great rate at all. And furthermore, the Safe Drinking Water Act closely regulates how oil and gas disposes of the produced water, like Mr. Carlson, through the underground injection well program with EPA oversight over Colorado's Department of Public Health and Environment.
Well, I would like to welcome Sloan Shoemaker back. You were about to make a point there around responding to Kent Haldinger, responding to a caller about whether or not we do have to drill for all the natural resources in the state. Please go ahead, Sloan Shoemaker.
Yeah, the point I'm trying to make is simply that we, our energy use in this nation is very wasteful, that there's so many opportunities for more efficiency. And closing that efficiency gap really should be the resource we mine first before we embark on these very risky endeavors that have some potentially long-term consequences, like all these legacy wells, which it would seem to common sense it's only a matter of time before they rust out and something's left to seep into the aquifer. So that's my concern is that we don't have, we're not having the right conversation. The conversation should be about how do we get more from less, not how do we just get more. And one thing that the caller mentioned was the Thompson Divide, which is a 200,000 acre landscape outside of Carbondale that right now is substantially undeveloped, and the local communities are unified around keeping it in that way because they're concerned about surface water contamination that could impact the agricultural economy here. They're concerned about fragmentation of the forest and disruption of wildlife, and this is in the hunting industry and the wildlife is one of the mainstays of our economy here, and it's a recreation-based community too. So, clean air and clean water are essentially important, are really critically important to our economy, and we don't want to trade that for natural gas energy development boom jobs that are going to disappear and leave a mess for us to clean up. So, I just we don't have to drill everywhere, and when we do it right. And granted, Colorado is on the forefront of that, and kudos to this state for doing that. And but that didn't happen easily or willingly. It happened because a lot of people worked very hard to overcome industry influence to start exerting some more controls and some more regulations and some more oversight. And so I'm sure we've got further to go on that, and I'm very proud of the state for going as far as it has.
That's Sloan Shoemaker, head of the Western Slope Conservation Group Wilderness Workshop. He's joining us on the phone from Carbondale. We just have about two or three more minutes left in the show, and I would like to go back to the phone lines and welcome Barbara in Colorado Springs. Welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Yes. The gentleman just remarked that thanks to the developments of fracking and directional drilling, we now have miles of lateral gas lines across the state of Colorado. Well, as all of us know, in the last 10 years, thanks to global warming, we've been plagued with wildfires across the state. These are unexpected. They were uncontrollable. And my deep concern is what's going to occur when wildfires conflict or come into contact with these miles and miles of lateral gas lines across the state.
Well, Barbara, thank you for your comment. If I could ask you to turn down the radio that you have on in the background.
I'm going to just go away and listen.
Sounds good. And then Ken Carlson at CSU, is this something you can respond to? What about the possibility for wildfire with all of these pipelines?
It's an interesting question. You know, what's primarily responsible for the issue in our forests these days is a lack of management. Through fire suppression over decades and environmentalist litigation and appeals, we have virtually no timber industry left in the state. So our forests grew incredibly over-dense, and after a series of drought years, we're now stuck with the pine beetle epidemic and the risk of catastrophic wildfires. It has nothing to do with oil and gas and everything to do with the mentality that we shouldn't be managing and using wisely our resources.
Well, that's a whole other argument that I encourage these radio stations to have a separate show on. And there's so many misstatements and fallacies in what Ken just said that I think that I'm not going to take time to rebut them all now. But there are plenty of places where you've got sagebrush and pinyon juniper forests that these gas lines go through. And that has nothing to do with commercial timber sales and appeals from environmental industry. That's just bonk.
Well, I will give that as the last word because we are wrapping up our show today. That was Sloan Shoemaker, head of the Western Slope Conservation Group Wilderness Workshop. We were also joined by Ken Carlson, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Colorado State University. He's the director of the Center for Energy Water Sustainability within the CSU Energy Institute. Also joining us today was our guest, Kent Halsinger, a natural resources attorney in Denver. You've been listening to a special statewide call-in program on water and energy produced by Rocky Mountain Community Radio in partnership with the Colorado Foundation for Water Education. It's part of our year-long series on Colorado water called Connecting the Drops. The foundation invites listeners to become fluent in Colorado water by visiting their website, yourwatercolorado.org. Thanks to all our listeners and callers from KGNU here in Boulder and Denver, from KDNK in Carbondale and KRCC in Colorado Springs. We had production assistance from Steve Skinner, Andrea Chalfin and Sam Fuqua. And thanks to our technical team, Joel Bielik, John Banks and Evan Perkins. For Connecting the Drops, I'm Maeve Conran. Thank you for listening.
We are living made of water.
Down the river, follow the current down.
Live on land, return to river.
Follow the current down.
River sits.